All right, think of everything that's great about the state fair. Body-crushing crowds, expensive, craptastic food on a stick, the stench of 15,000 animals pooping at one time, politicians around every corner. Actually, yeah, I'm not so sure about that last one. I know it's a state fair ritual, politicians shaking hands, hoping you're going to spend some of your fun fair time at their booth talking politics, I guess. Here at the fair, it's the same pressure we're getting outside every time we turn on the TV right now, and it's only going to get stronger. Time to choose your horse. Line up behind your favorite candidate. Even at the fair, you can't escape it. We're heading into that magical time for taking sides. And that is our theme for this In the Loop Story Slam. All right, I'm Jeff Horwich, and for this slam, we have ventured out of our usual dark, comfortable cabaret and into the sun of the Minnesota State Fair. I'm on the stage of the Minnesota Public Radio booth with an audience who didn't pay anything and will quickly wander off to the tilt-a-whirl if this gets boring. So here, very quickly, is how this works. We have set a theme, taking sides. Storytellers have signed up to step on stage and give us their best take on that theme, and they can take it any direction they want. They don't have to go the political way. There are always surprises because we have no idea what stories are coming. Our house band, The Smarts, is here, and they'll be improvising us from one story to the next. We've been listening to them warm up the crowd here for a while. The Smarts and I are going to weigh in with some musical takes on taking sides to mix things up as we move along. So, everybody bunch up uncomfortably close to somebody you wouldn't normally associate with. Plug your mouth with something greasy enough to make you puke. And take a deep breath of barnyard perfume. Coming to you from the Minnesota State Fair, this is the Story Slam from In the Loop. And I'd like to welcome Holly Davis up to the stage with me.
Hi.
And the Holly Davis fan club in the audience.
Really with us. Right, brought them with.
So you're just back from a year overseas. Where were you?
We lived in Hong Kong for a year.
Oh, wow. What did you think?
Oh, God, it's fantastic. It's a beautiful city, very cosmopolitan, and it's a cool time to be in China. It's a lot of energy, a lot of excitement about the future there.
And I see here also, you've never been to the state fair before.
Well, I went once 100 years ago to an Alabama concert, but that's about it.
So what do you think? Is this more exciting than Hong Kong?
No, not really. Okay. No.
It's just different.
Different, right.
It's a different kind of excitement. All right, well, Holly Davis, pleased to welcome you for the first time to one of our Story Slams.
Thanks so much.
Glad you could join us.
Okay. I'm not particularly good at playing sports, and I accept this, but it seems unfair that I am also not very good at watching sports. The latter is the more unfortunate because the only requirements are the ability to sit, eat potato chips, and consume vast quantities of beer, things for which I am eminently qualified. My failure at spectator sports doesn't reflect a lack of interest on my part. I find many sports enthralling: tennis, basketball, even sumo. I recently spent an entire afternoon in Tokyo, surrounded by rotund fellows, rikishi, wearing diapers called mawashi, but that's another story altogether. What each of these events has in common, however, is the same painful dilemma: that of taking sides. I want everyone to win. The Olympics are a 16-day spectacle of extraordinary skill, determination, and for me, a roller coaster of emotion. Some contests are easy ones. Of course, I want the American beach volleyball team of May Traynor and Walsh to defend their Olympic gold, and Michael Phelps to break a gazillion records, and Nasty and Sean to sweep gymnastics. But please, please don't ask me to ignore the Australian swimmer, Grant the Machine Hackett, who came to Beijing trying to become the first male swimmer to win 3 consecutive golds in the same event, but alas, took silver. Or Indian rifleman Abhinav Bindra, who brought the world's second most populated nation in the world its only gold medal of these Olympic Games. Or controversial Chinese gymnast Yang Yilin, who is forced to wear blue eyeshadow to make her look older, but instead looks like a 14-year-old gymnast with no fashion sense. I want all of the opening ceremony dancers to hit their cues so that the Dove of Peace, made with something like 5,000 people, doesn't have an unsightly appendage when Chin Yaw trips over Wang Hong. Yes, I want some country from Africa to win the Best Dressed Award from the Parade of Nations. Yes, I want Hank, the Clydesdale horse, to make the Budweiser team. Yes, I want it all. And the energy I expend trying to make that happen is, quite frankly, exhausting me. None of these complex emotions enter the political arena, where I am decisively partisan and, at this point in time, bored to tears. How much better if the candidates could labor obscurely for 4 years and then burst onto the scene for 16 days to make their case? They play negative ads in heats, debate in qualifying rounds, pick their VP candidates in the semis, and then in the final, it's mano on mano, or womano, as the case will surely someday be. Frozen under the glaring light of the sumo ring, fully exposed in their revealing mawashi, they are locked in the ancient technique of suri dashi, grabbing the opponent's loincloth and lifting upward. More of a divider than a uniter. Sure, the idea needs some refining, but I think it's well worth investigating. The thing about the Olympics is that in spite of all our nationalistic tendencies, we manage to look at the opposition as people. Our shared humanity transcends the competition. And it's been a very long time since the same could be said for our political scene. I will try to remember this sentiment when I sit in front of the television watching the election results come in. And if my particular candidate loses, well, I've always got more potato chips and beer.
Thank you very much, Holly Davis. Thanks a lot, fellas. The smarts, of course. I'm Jeff Horwich. Our theme out here at the Minnesota State Fair today, inspired maybe by the political season that's very much upon us now, taking sides. Diego Vasquez, how are you doing today?
Good, I'm doing good.
Now, says here you're a poetry slammer, founder of the Minnesota Poetry Slam.
A long time ago, 1995 at Kieran's Irish Pub.
Wow, so you're going to adapt some of your poetry slamming style here to our story-ish format?
Probably not.
What do you say? Well, do whatever you want. You're on stage now, so what the heck can I do? It says you started out very political, but as you've grown older, and you look about 25 to me, I don't know what you're talking about.
Of course.
But you've mellowed with age. What's happened to you?
Sides have become cloudier.
More shades of gray.
More shades of gray, yeah.
All right. Give us your take on our theme here, taking sides and the cloudiness or clarity of it.
All right.
Diego Vasquez.
During wartime, sides are easy to take, and you can't avoid taking sides. I've developed a new theory about families and the generational chips that are paid during different wars. I had one uncle who was part of that confetti in the sky that landed on Normandy. He came back home to El Paso, Texas, missing a leg. I had another uncle who became a casualty of the European theater, never came back home. I had a father who survived 13 months of nonstop shelling on Guadalcanal as a Marine medic. And when he found out that I was being drafted for Vietnam, the very first thing he told me was, "Go to Canada, son. Don't let them take you." I had a couple of other uncles who had survived World War II. They also chimed in, "Don't let them take you." When they knew I was eligible, and I became more than eligible because during the draft, during the lottery, my number was 11. So they knew that I was going to be called. They knew I was going to get the letter. And they all encouraged me, "Do something else. You don't have to be that patriotic. We kind of paid the price already. We don't want to lose another one. We don't have to. I let them take me. I never could get to Canada, and I never was capable of producing the documentation within my head to claim conscientious objector status, even though I had spent 2 years working with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee, and Chavez had steered me toward the beauty of the language and the thought process of Gandhi. All of me believed in nonviolent change, and I let the army take me. Something deeper within me said, I need to be patriotic. In boot camp, I was quite the sad sack. Barely got through boot camp. I was not your first-class soldier. Having never lifted a weapon in my life, it took a while to understand how to shoot it. I made it through boot camp. Then there's this thing called AIT, Advanced Individual Training, or Advanced Infantry Training. When I got there, you know you're leaving. When you finish this one, you're going overseas. That was like 7,000 times worse than boot camp. Boot camp was like Boy Scout camp compared to this other training. And they all said, we're training you to survive so you can come back. The war was winding down. That war in Vietnam, that was never a war. There were 13 of us going to Subic Bay in the Philippines. That was the drop-off point to go over there. Suddenly, overnight, our drill sergeant comes up and says, hey, some orders got cut. We don't need to send 13 people over there. We're only sending 11. Two of you are getting cut. And I decided to lop off the last two in the alphabet. The first one he lopped off was a kid named something before the V. I didn't even pay attention. And then there was Vasquez. You're not going. Something bigger made the decision for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Diego Vasquez. We should probably fill in the huhs and absolutely nothing. Sorry.
We're thinking about it.
They're in there somewhere.
You were all thinking it.
Okay. The Smarts improvising us from story to story here on the In the Loop Story Slam. If you want to learn more about In the Loop Story Slams and the week from In the Loop, which is our Friday night program, you can go to minnesotapublicradio.org. Look for In the Loop. We've got a podcast there. We've got a blog. All kinds of good stuff. And, of course, you can find out when our next Story Slam is going to occur. Today, we're at the Minnesota State Fair, and with me now is Sarah Martin.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Sarah, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Nice to see you again. Let me learn a little about you from this card they've just handed me. Oh, this is very interesting. You've been a vegetarian for 4 years.
Yes.
And this year, at the State Fair, what's happening?
Oh, well, you know, I did give it up several months ago, but I had not come to the State Fair for many years.
So this will be your first State Fair as a meatitarian.
In a very long time, yes.
Carnivore.
Yes.
Applause from our stage manager, Alan. Have you hit the booths yet?
You know, I had some sausages while waiting for this event to begin, and they were very good. They're right over there.
Okay. Now, for some people, that would come as quite a shock. I would think that meat at the State Fair would be enough to maybe send them back the other direction.
Not a lot of chance of that. It's dark on the other side, trust me.
Welcome back to the world of us carnivores, I guess. And welcome back to the Story Slam. This is Sarah Martin.
The first election that I can vividly remember was in 1992. It was Bush, the senior, against Clinton, the mister. I had just started middle school, and while, you know, the age of 11 or 12 is awkward for a lot of people, it was perhaps more awkward for the kid who wears cow print homemade jumpsuits to school, and purple corduroy leggings. I was the strange kid, but going to a new school is very, very exciting for a lot of people because no one there, at least half the school or more, doesn't know how weird you are. At least that's what you think. So it was my great hope that in my first week or two, I could finally make some friends. Our civics classes were following the election. And in the first couple of weeks of school, we decided to hold a mock election. We're all sitting in class, and I'm not really paying a lot of attention, figuring that I'm not the sort of person who gets picked for these kinds of things. And the first candidate was a kid named Kyle, who was selected. I won't say his last name because it's the Great Minnesota Get-Together, and he may be here somewhere. And I didn't know anything about him except that he was kind of funny and really tall and handsome in that I'm going to punch you in the arm if you talk to me kind of way. And as soon as he was selected, it was like everyone in the class was standing in a line and everyone took a step back but me to run against him. So I wound up on the other side of the ticket. The class had to decide what our debate topic would be at the end of the 2 weeks. And I don't know what possessed my sixth grade teacher to decide that the class could choose abortion. But there I am at 11 years old, staring at a 3x5 index card, trying to decide before class is over in 15 minutes how I feel about abortion. I decided to write down pro-choice. I don't really remember why. I think it was mostly because I was a proto-budding feminist and was deciding to have opinions, and that seemed like a good one. It turned out that that Kyle's choice was pro-life, as was the choice of almost everyone else in the school, which I didn't realize until I came into class the next day, and in all the posters that were lining the history and social studies hallway for all of the candidates, there were some that stood out because they were glittery and sparkly and done in puff paint, and there were some that stood out because they said the words, "Sarah Martin is a baby killer." Which made me cry. But the school decided that it was a free speech. They weren't going to censor anyone, so despite the crying, they wouldn't let me take them down. I don't think I really need to describe how badly I was trounced in that mock election. The cow print jumpsuits didn't help. The thing about it is that for a mock election, I think that might be the most accurate picture of American politics one could possibly come up with. So every time I see a candidate who's being smeared in the media, I think of, well, maybe they just weren't cool enough to be there in the first place. Thanks.
That's Sarah Martin. I'm Jeff Horwich, host of In the Loop. We're doing a story slam here out at the State Fair. I don't know if people on the radio can hear it, but like across the way, we've been hearing like the screams, the exuberant screams of dozens, maybe hundreds of tweeny-aged women. It seems to be coming from the dairy building. That doesn't make a lot of sense, but maybe they're just getting Barack Obama's text message. I'm very excited. Next to join me on the stage of the story slam is Kurt Lund.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Kurt. Says here you've been a political activist since kindergarten.
It's true.
What the heck were you up to in kindergarten?
I don't know how it happened. My parents are both Democrats, but I was a staunch Reaganite. Campaigned in my kindergarten classroom for Reagan. Nobody had any idea who Reagan was or what a president did.
What about Reagan or his policies resonated with you as a five-year-old?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Maybe equal access to sandboxes.
Supply-side economics, that kind of thing?
Well, of course, yeah.
All right. Kurt Lund, welcome to the Story Slam. Give us your best on taking sides, our theme today.
We've been dating for about 3 weeks, and nothing horrible has happened yet, which, given my history in the romance department, is saying something. So far, we had successfully navigated several of the potentially hazardous milestones of any new young adult relationship. The first time you meet their best friends, scary. The first time you go out with a big group of their friends, terrifying. The first time you let them win at Scrabble. Now, 3 weeks and 5 days in, I had planned to spend the night, and I realized that I was about to cross another of these milestones. The first time you... pardon my French. The first time you poo at their place? What if it's loud? What if an odor travels under the door and into the rest of the apartment? What if the door doesn't lock and they walk in? What if the toilet won't flush? What if it does flush, but then it overflows? It's almost too much to bear. But if the relationship is going to last, you've got to take the leap eventually. I locked the door, checked the door handle, started with a test flush. Appears to be operational. I dug under the sink, found a spare roll of toilet paper and an air freshener just in case. I'd smuggled in some scented tea lights from the dining room and lit those for good measure. Everything seemed as good as it was gonna get. And that's when I saw it. The toilet paper roll. On the wall, just to the left of the tank, dispensing from underneath the spindle. Well, that's silly, I thought. He must have put the roll on backwards. I mean, everybody knows it goes the other way, right? I popped it out, turned it around, and put it back in. At the end of that week, we were back at his place, and once again, I found myself staring down that toilet paper roll, backwards once again, the loose end waving defiantly in the breeze from the air conditioning vent, taunting me. Well, I had to do it. Popped it out, flipped it around, popped it back in. Trust me, I slept better. That Sunday evening, he came over to my place. We ordered a pizza, watched some TV, and fell asleep on the couch. The next morning, he got ready before me and headed off to work. I stumbled into the bathroom later and... oh, heck no. A fresh new roll of toilet paper, blindingly white and double quilted, unrolling the wrong way. A telltale pair of squares peeking out from underneath. I decided to make one more valiant, passive-aggressive attempt at taking a stand. Apparently so did he. Over the course of that next week, toilet paper was switched and switched back with every trip to either apartment's bathroom. The telltale click-click of the spring-loaded spindle became so commonplace, the people in the next apartment probably thought we had taken up the castanets. In hindsight, maybe I could have handled the conflict a little better, but I guess I felt cornered, and the only option was to stay and defend my territory. To the point that we stopped speaking entirely, communicating only in toilet paper-fueled smoke signals. Neither of us actually officially broke up with the other. One of us would have had to say something to the other to do that, but I considered it mutual. I guess in all those crash-and-burn endings to all those previous would-be relationships, I had learned one thing after all. Nobody puts Curdy in a corner.
Kurt Lund. Thanks, Kurt. You kind of got to play that one out to the end, don't you? That's the Smarts improvising us from story to story here at the Story Slam. We're coming to you from the Minnesota State Fair today. Woo-hoo! I'm Jeff Horwich, and our theme is Taking Sides. And a couple times during the show, we like to dive into a musical take on our theme, and this is mine. Somehow, when I start thinking about taking sides in politics and elections, I don't know, and a few times in the past, has given way to a bluegrass song. So, bluegrass it is. And the Smarts are going to join me on it. When I was just a little tyke, well, I looked around and thought, you know what I might like. Someday I'll run that race, cause you know I should run this place. All you need's a little chutzpah and a halfway pretty face. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, good day. Allow me but a moment just to say, I humbly seek your vote, and on that humble note, remind you how I'm great in every way. Yes, I've got 8 different kinds of degrees. Earn my purple heart while fighting Charlie and the trees. Look into my eyes, it should come as no surprise that my interns and my pages might go weak around the knees. Hey, vote for me. Yeah, vote for me. I'm here to save the country. There's no time for modesty. Takes an ego more than just a little large to step up and say that you're the one who should be put in charge. For my opponent, I have the deepest of respect. I'm sure if you turn your back, he'd wring your mother's neck. If you have to shake his hand, be careful where you stand. And when he walks away, you'll want to do a wallet check. His proposals are just this side of nuts. He associates with hucksters, shysters, vagabonds, and sluts. Well, frankly, I'm amazed at the other side these days. If the best that they can give us is this unredeeming putz. Hey, vote for me. Yep, vote for me. The choice is rather simple. He's a moron, don't you see? God help your friend if you help him to win. Knowing that you help create this pile of crap we're in. And I'm the only one with the experience to change the way that Washington is run. I got all it takes to lead. Your vote's the last remaining thing I need. Take a little solo there, Jimbo. Such a humble man. Step up here and tell you just how great I am. That's what I gotta do. I'll make that sacrifice for you. Just as long as you can do a little something for me too. Hey, vote for me. Yes,
yeah,
vote for me. Yes, I'm telling you I'm awesome, but I'm down on bended knee. Takes an ego more than just a little large. Step up and say that you're the one who should be put in charge. Hey, vote for me. Yes, vote for me. Come on, put my name up in your yard and vote for me. Knock on all your neighbors' doors and vote for me. Spend just a few hours in the phone bank if you would and vote for me. Host a fundraiser at your house to shake down all your friends and vote for me. Vote for me. Yeah, vote for me. Thank you very much. This is the In the Loop Story Slam. I'm Jeff Horwich. We are on the stage of the Minnesota Public Radio booth today at the Minnesota State Fair. It is, what, 75 out here and sunny, and we have a wonderful crowd gathered at the booth. Linda Lee, welcome back to the Story Slam.
Thank you.
Sister, you don't believe in taking sides. Now, do you mean like just our theme today or generally the concept?
In general, I try to avoid taking sides. I don't believe in it in general.
Are you sort of generally just a very even-keeled kind of person? Is that what...
Well, I don't think my husband would necessarily agree with that. But, you know, I belong to one of these New Age religions that doesn't really believe in heaven or hell, and we're all good people. So what, you know, we're all on the same side. We're all human beings. We all share the same planet. That's one big side in my book.
We'll take us a little bit deeper into that with your story here. Linda Lee on the In the Loop Story Slam.
Do you guys remember that old game? Red Rover, Red Rover, send Linda right over. That was my favorite game when I was a kid growing up. Of course, the euphorian in me loves the fact that there is never a winner or a loser in this game. In fact, the worst case scenario, the worst possible thing that could happen in Red Rover is that everybody would end up on one big team together. I love that. if like world international politics could be handled this way, just think how great that would be. Can't you see George W. out there? He's got Laura on one hand. He's got Condoleezza on the other hand. And he's out there like, Red Rover, send Osama right over. And then Osama would come running across the field, and if he found a weak link, then he would break through, right? And then he would take somebody from our team back to play on his team. But if he didn't break through, then he would have to come and play on our team. That would be such a great way to run a war, I think. So I've heard somebody say once that every storyteller really just has one story, that all of their other stories really boils down to this one story. And I think that one story for me is life as a game of Red Rover. So for example, I can tell you I had my first professional storytelling gig last spring, and I was able to perform my one-woman show, Essentials, at a spiritual performance festival over in Uptown. That was very exciting. I performed my show 5 times over the course of the week, and I think my favorite one was the night that all the other storytellers who could come came to my show. And I looked out, and I could see them all out there in the audience, and I felt like we were all on one big team together. And I just felt like I was a part of something bigger than myself, and I just loved that. And I performed my little heart out. And towards the end of my show, I have this thing where we hand out like a greeting card, a beautiful greeting card to everyone in the audience. And then everybody writes a sincere compliment to somebody else in the room. It's a secret. You write it down, then you put it in the envelope and seal it. And it's addressed to that person. And I collect them all. I take them home. I stamp them and I mail them. And then everybody who came to the show in a few days is going to get a card in the mail with a beautiful compliment that was written especially for them. I wrapped up my show, I took the cards home, and I was really feeling kind of warm and fuzzy about it all, and it was all so exciting. As I put the stamps on the cards and prepared to mail them the next day, I noticed that one of the envelopes was not sealed. So I probably shouldn't have done this, but honestly, I didn't even think about it in the moment. I opened the envelope, and I took out the card, and I read it. And I have to tell you, this was not just one of the other storytellers. It was actually a woman who was in a leadership role for this spiritual performance festival. And I opened the card to see what wonderful compliment she wrote for her friend. And inside the card, it said, "You have the patience to sit through this crap." Well, ow. I thought, this is not the way this game is supposed to be played. This is not how we play Red Rover. This is how we play hockey, where you hit people with sticks. But then I thought, you know, this is the beauty of being a storyteller. I get to craft this tale the way I want it to play out. And so the way that I see this playing out is that some way, somehow, this woman and I, there's going to be a twist of fate, and we're going to somehow end up being like best friends, like maybe even lesbian lovers. All right, that's probably not going to happen, but you know what I mean. We're going to find ourselves feeling something like love and respect for each other. And that's kind of exciting to just wonder, how is that going to happen? I have no idea, but I have full confidence that it will. So, Red Rover, send her right over. Bring them on. Come on, baby, I'm ready for you.
Linda Lee, thanks, Linda. And believe it or not, a butterfly flitted across the stage in the middle of Linda's story. I thought that was appropriate. We're out here at the Minnesota State Fair doing our In the Loop Story Slam today. To the left of me is running neon French fry man. And staring at us from across the way is a giant inflatable marine. Which I think his job is to help our storytellers wrap up their stories on time.
I think it is. It's true, yes.
Remind you that you have only 5 minutes. Allegra Lingo, welcome back to the Story Slam.
Thank you.
Now, you love the fair, do you?
I do. I'm a total fair addict.
And we got some nice news on the card I was just handed here. It says you just got engaged.
In fact,
you're still hungover from partying last night.
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
I just got engaged about a month ago. Thank you.
Oh, I see.
And we had
you're hungover from drinking all month.
Well, exactly. No, we had a big engagement party at our house last night, and so I think I went to bed at like two or so, and got up here this morning. So there you go. Yeah.
Well, the bright sun in your face and that big fat Marine over there.
Yeah, the Marine is staring me down. I gotta say.
They will
say.
Shake you out of your hungoverness. Allegra lingo. Go for it.
All right. Over the past 2 weeks, a good chunk of my time has been spent on our living room couch watching the Olympics. Now, I'm not a huge sports fan, but I've got some weird Pavlovian response to the John Williams penned Olympic fanfare, and it is not possible for me to get up from the couch until Bob Costas has said good night from Beijing. A few days ago, the primetime coverage began with the women's marathon. And in years past, they've shown the start of the marathon, break away to more action-packed sports, and then check in on the racers every so often. But not this year. They showed the entire marathon. All 2 hours, 26 minutes, and 44 seconds of it. And since Bob Costas had not said goodnight from Beijing, I sat and I watched all 2 hours, 26 minutes, and 44 seconds of it. It was a gorgeous course through Beijing, and as the runners passed by the Temple of Heaven, Amy turned to me and said, "You know, our country is just a child compared to China. I mean, to them, we're not even a teenager. We are still a toddler running around yelling, 'Mine, mine, mine!'" Which would certainly justify a lot of our foreign policy these days. A Romanian woman won the marathon, and I choked up a bit as she separated herself from the pack, entered the stadium to do one lap before crossing the finish line, and the extra boost of energy she got from the crowd as they cheered her on, waving their flags, looking so proud. I choke up during the human interest stories as well. Bob Costas narrated a piece on the ping pong diplomacy in 1971, showing clips of the U.S. and Chinese players using their sport to begin to bring down that red curtain. And then they just had to show the Chinese man's first trip to the U.S. earlier this year when he had heard that his ping pong compatriot counterpart had suddenly died and he wanted to pay his respects. Now, Costas ended the clip by saying, even though it wasn't an Olympic event, it was what these games are all about, sports and friendship before politics. That led directly into a rehash of the medal count, with obvious triumph at how much the USA was out in front. I watch not to see how many medals we have, and what I'll remember isn't the total medal count. But even the cynic in me, who roots for the underdog at any time, couldn't help but anxiously await Michael Phelps' medley relay to see if he could win his 8th gold medal in these games. I actually hit the TiVo button to press pause on my TV before watching the race because I was so hyped up. I sat in my writing studio and grabbed a smoke, and a few minutes later, from all around our neighborhood, this chorus of cheers and yells rang out at once all across the dark summer sky. We then went ahead and watched the race and yelled at ourselves in triumph, watching the winning relay team. I might have been a couple minutes late to the party, but that moment of audio triumph from across the neighborhood was worth it. See, we're all here together, cheering for the same thing. So thank you, Michael Phelps, and thank you, Beijing. I might not be a red, white, and blue wearer much of the time, but that moment I was incredibly proud to call that medley relay team fellow countrymen. So guess what? Game on.
Game on, Allegra Lingo. Thanks. The Smarts, our house band here on In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, and we're at the Minnesota State Fair for our Story Slam. Gabe Heller, how are you doing?
Oh, not too bad, not too bad.
It says here on the card I've got that you usually go to Burning Man, which
yes.
is in the southwest, right?
Where yes,
is
it? Arizona, in Nevada, in the sort of northwest okay. corner of Nevada.
But when you can't go to Burning Man, you come to the State Fair.
Yes.
Is that a reasonable substitute?
Well, it's certainly a lot cheaper. When I can't afford to go there, I go here.
You don't have the same sort of cathartic destruction.
No, but it does have the inflatable Marine, you know, which...
That's true.
Which they don't have at Burning Man.
Gabe, welcome back to the Story Slam. Glad you made it up on stage with us. Let's hear what you got.
Okay. So, since graduating from college, my life has been characterized by multi-year periods of frenetic activity for somewhat reasonable pay, interspersed with year-and-a-half periods of lazy underemployment and mild destitution. Currently, I'm mostly underemployed. The last time this happened, I made the mistake of attempting to remedy this through the use of an employment agency. After a math test with questions designed to make sure I knew what fractions were, I found myself hauling glass around by hand inside a glass factory in northeast Minneapolis. Did I mention my degrees in computer science? When I arrived at this factory, I was greeted by two factions who would vie for my loyalty over the next few weeks. The condescendingly friendly and mostly clueless managers were all white. The affably brusque but practically brilliant floor workers were all African Americans or recent immigrants from south of the border. Describing my duties, a manager said, "Now, every time you break a piece of glass, you are to fill out this form and place it in this box by the floor manager's cubicle, and he'll issue an order for it to be recut." Later, the de facto leader of the floor workers told me, "Now, whenever you break a piece of glass, you go talk to my homie Maurice, and he'll hook you up." I have never been particularly fond of racial division, nor do I particularly like to take sides. In fact, I hate taking sides, but I wasn't too worried. I'll just be really careful, I told myself, and never break any glass. Within an hour, that resolution was as broken as the bevel-edged mirror I bumped into with my cart. Now, I briefly considered satisfying both constituencies, but then I remembered this was a union shop. If I did both, I would undoubtedly end up with two identical beveled mirrors to replace the one I broke. And I've also never been particularly fond of wasteful duplication, but I didn't want to take sides either, so every time I broke a piece of glass, I flipped a coin. Heads, I filled out a form. Tails, I went and talked to Maurice. This initially made me a quite popular person until both sides realized what was going on and briefly came together on a bipartisan basis to get rid of me. But before I got the call that said, "Don't bother showing up tomorrow," they did introduce me to some of the fancier glass processing machines and made me aware of precisely how deep this cultural divide went. Italy has been processing glass industrially for longer than any other country. All the best glass machines are made in Italy. As a result, they are all calibrated in metric units. But we were processing American-made glass measured in fractions of an inch, so all the basic measurements, 1/16, 1/8, 1/4, etc., needed to be converted into metric. Everyone who calibrated the machines had a little cheat sheet in their pocket. After a few days on the fancy machines, I noticed they were being recalibrated much more often than seemed necessary to me, nearly as often as operators changed. Initially, I thought perhaps this was due to some obscure union rule designed to slow things down. But then, I found two of those crumpled cheat sheets on the floor, and it all became clear. Each group had done its own set of English to metric conversions. The managers had rounded up, and the floor workers had rounded down. And therefore they were different, and each set worked in and of itself, but whenever one group looked at a machine calibrated by the other, it looked wrong, and they recalibrated it according to their set of calculations. And every time something went wrong, each group blamed the other for miscalibrating the machines. I admit I did toy with the idea of trying to bring all sides together to discuss their differences, find common ground, and maybe even come to a common set of English to metric conversions. But as I left the factory for the last time, I thought better of it. If simply refusing to take sides could get me fired, attempting actual mediation might get me killed. And after all, what piece of glass doesn't have two sides? Thank you.
Thank you, Gabe. Gabe Heller. This is the In the Loop Story Slam here at the Minnesota State Fair, and it's time to let our house band, The Smarts, take a whack at our theme today, taking sides. So, Joe Weissman, bass player, lyricist for the most part, what were you thinking about when you wrote this rockin' tune for us?
Well, this is a song about the people who tend to take the opposite side of you no matter what, especially when you're driving, and they literally and figuratively can't seem to remember which side of the car they chose to sit on. But to make it more fun, we also wrote it from the point of view of a person who sounds like they could use some backseat driving in their life. It's called Backseat Driver. You don't have to run my life. I can screw it up by myself. You don't have to backseat drive. I can tell the yellow from red. Pick a side of the deal, known as mine, the one that's got the steering wheel. I don't have to get a job, I'll make money just being cool. You don't have to lecture me, I never did enroll in your school. Pick a side of the coin, I say why.
say color's not the point.
My way.
I do is wrong. It's a wonder how I ever could go before you finally came along to find a tug of war for your rope.
Okay, fine, I admit you were right.
Doesn't mean I give a crap.
You took a side that wasn't there. Fight with someone who doesn't care.
Da 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 da.
The Smarts. Let me tell you a little about the Smarts. Joe Weissman on bass, Jimmy Kennedy on keys, Morris Engel on drums there. Learn more about them at thesmartsband.com, or you can go to minnesotapublicradio.org, the In the Loop homepage, and we'll link you straight to it. We're at the Minnesota State Fair today doing our In the Loop Story Slam. I'm Jeff Horwich, taking sides the theme, and Catherine Glover, welcome back to the Story Slam. I think you've joined us once
Thanks.
Before, right?
Yes, correct.
Oh, we're glad to have you. You're a little crabby because the price of the fair went up.
Yeah, $11. When did that happen?
I don't know. You're asking the wrong guy. But are you every year come to the fair?
No, I haven't
person?
Been here, and I don't even remember the last time I was here.
The price went up since 10 years ago.
I think I was probably about 3 feet tall the last time I was here. So.
Oh, well, now that you have to pay, you're all crabby about the price. Of course. All right, well, I'll let you tell your story. Catherine Glover,
okay.
Thanks for being here.
Great. It's hard to learn a language when you're in your 70s. But Amina, one of my English students from Somalia, tries her darndest. She is really good at spelling. She's always writing things on scraps of paper and showing them to me. Thank you, thank teacher good. Or George Washington, the United States flag have 50 star. She's studying for her citizenship test. She tries to tell me this in Somali just before class one day. I explain, I don't speak Somali, Amina. I can't understand you. She laughs and nods and keeps talking in Somali, but she throws in enough English words like citizen and testy that I figure it out. It helps that she's just written the 13 original colony names from memory. I have two objectives for tonight's class: to introduce question forms using who and to practice addressing envelopes. A lot of my students confuse the to address and the from address, or they write the to so far up and to the right there's no room for the stamp, or they write their phone number instead of their zip code. So I figure envelopes will take up most of the class. But we get distracted by the questions. My first examples involve them, my students. Who has blue eyes? Mohammed has blue eyes. And Mohammed says, teacher, why are you looking in my eyes? So I switch to politicians. Who is the president? They all know that one. Who is the vice president? Amina says, George Washington. Good, Amina. George Washington was the first president, but who is the vice president? They don't know. But they want to know, and they won't let me change the subject. I grimace as I write the words Dick Cheney on the whiteboard. Then, kind of curious to test their knowledge, I ask, who is the governor of Minnesota? And Naima says a word that I can't make out. Weso, Walson. Before, she adds, not now. And it hits me. She's saying Wellstone, as in former Senator Paul Wellstone. It touches a nerve. I lightly use Bush as a teaching example all the time, and I manage not to add any snarky commentary. But Wellstone, it was just so tragic, so unfair. And it's incredible Naima knows who he is. She was still in Somalia then. I want to tell them everything, how horrible it was, how when he died in that plane crash just before the election, his Senate seat quietly went to Bush boy, and... But no, My job is not to espouse my political views or complain about the unfairness of the world. My job is to teach English. And today in particular, to try to save our local postal workers a lot of headaches. I tell my students Wellstone was a very popular senator, but he died in a plane crash. I tell them a governor is different than a senator, but I'll explain all of that to them some other day. I take out a pile of envelopes. But my students want to know who our senator is. I quickly write Norm Coleman on the board, which is now empty except for the words Dick Cheney, Norm Coleman, Senator, Vice President, and Governor. I am so depressed. And then, through the darkness of these Republican times, Amina's voice rings out, Mark Dayton! Mark Dayton! I turn around and her eyes are shining. Good job, Amina, I say. Wow, that's great. She laughs and nods. No one else has any idea who she's talking about. Amina nods again and keeps on laughing. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Catherine Glover. Dawn Brody, welcome back to the In the Loop Story Slam. Very nice to see you.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
Now, we have our Republican National Convention coming up here in St. Paul shortly. And you've got plans for it.
I do. I'm going to be entertaining the Republicans while they're in town.
In what guise?
I'm going to be a gangster and taking them on a gangster tour. St. Paul has a very deep, rich gangster history, and the Republicans are curious about it. So
you'll be suited up with all your bling.
That's
and
right.
Your,
they let us bring the guns.
A
on
gun
the bus,
in your pocket.
So, yeah.
What's the message that you want to leave with these Republican visitors after a gangster tour of our fair city?
I would hope that I say thanks for all the cash. That's what I'm hoping to say.
Thank you for the tips. Yes.
Thank you for the tips.
What impression are they supposed to come away with? I mean, they'll see the inside of the convention center, but here they're getting out, and we're going to show them all the good stuff.
Yes, that they're in good company.
Dawn Brody on the stage here at the Minnesota Public Radio booth. Take it away.
Thank you. I felt my first spur of an individual's power at the age of 6 while laying on my stomach in my family's living room reading the TV guide. Now, I was the youngest of 3 girls and had already grown familiar and, frankly, resigned to the family dynamic as it existed, which was my oldest sister, Anne, always got her way. When she didn't, my other sister, Lisa, got her way. And I, as the baby in the family, was just really grateful to be allowed to carry their crap and call an occasional tie. The year was 1985, and it was 7 p.m., what's known in the television business as prime time. It began that evening as it usually did, which was my older sister, Anne, taking her presumed place in the living room in front of the large color television to watch MacGyver, right? Starring Richard Dean Anderson, very sexy brainiac who could stop bullets with hockey tickets. And my sister, Lisa, already taking her, you know, subservient position to Anne, was headed upstairs to watch the smaller black and white TV. Her favorite show was Family Ties. And it occurred to me in this moment that I also had a show that I wanted to watch. It was called Elf, and he was an adorable little puppet alien guy, and I had recently discovered a deep fondness for him, and I was 6, and damn it, I get my way too once in a while. And my sisters were very quick to dismiss me, but Mom, overhearing this kind of UN-like, swoops into the living room and decides there is a fair and benevolent way to decide this, and that is the way we decide most disputes in our family, which is to draw names out of a hat. So, we know how this is going to work. The first name out of the hat, you get to watch your show on the big color TV in the living room. Second name out of the hat, you get to watch your show on the black and white TV upstairs. And then this point was just really driven home. Dawn, baby. That means that if your name isn't drawn, you can't pout and scream and throw a fit. It just means you don't get to watch a show, and this is how we've all agreed, and okay. And I'm like, all right, you know, I get it. I'm 6, but I'm in. Now, things were very clearly laid out, and I'm feeling like I'm starting to understand how this works when something very unexpected happens, which is Mom pulls out Lisa's name from the hat. The middle child, which, God love her, finally, something goes her way. You know, she's not going to stick around and question it. She scampers into the living room and finally gets to see Michael J. Fox in color. You know, this is a big day. And then I realized that something else unbelievable has happened, which is Anne and I are going head to head. I mean, the first and the last. She, with power and distinction, a proven record. Me, young, the inexperienced, some might even say cocky underdog who was really piping up with energy for the first time. I mean, this is a big moment. And I'm also really starting to understand the power that the hat has. I mean, things could really be displaced. I mean, if we are really going to agree that this hat calls the shots, I might just get to play a game once in a while. You know, like race with my sisters and not just mark the finish line. You know, when we play Raiders of the Lost Ark, maybe I can do something more than just make the sound effects. I mean, I'm about to become a viable member of the family because of the hat. And Mom reaches into the hat and pulls out my name, the baby with a victory. Yeah, finally. And I can feel the power just surging upwards. Everything's going to be totally different from this moment on. And then I see my sister Anne descend like Lucifer. Her face contorts and her hands clench, and she proceeds to put on a display of hissy pouting like I've never seen in my life, let alone attempted. She's screaming, pounding her fists on the floor. She's pleading, she's crying, she's threatening. And my mom looked at me and said, well, you know what, Dawn? It looks like Anne's gonna watch her show tonight. Sorry, kid. I learned a very important lesson that day, which is fairness is always determined by those in power, and sometimes you really gotta scream your head off to get what you want.
A great lesson from Dawn Brody. Thanks, Dawn. The smarts pulling some semblance of the Cheers theme out of their butts for us here at the In the Loop Story Slam. Let's have one more round of applause for all of our storytellers who joined us up here at the Story Slam at the State Fair today. All right, we made it through, and the wind is just picking up, so I better wrap things up here. The Story Slam is produced by Melissa LaCase with help from In the Loop's trusty producer, my buddy Sandon Totten. Minnesota Public Radio's director of live events is Tony Bull. Extra assistance today from Anna Wagle, Ellen Chico Feliz Freckman, and photographer Jeremy Pavlik. Our engineers here at the fair have been Zach Rose and Cameron Wiley, with some production help from Michael Osborne. The smarts behind me here, this wonderful band, Jimmy Kennedy, Joe Weissman, and Morris Engel. More about them at thesmartsband.com. And you can learn a whole lot more about us, get involved with our various shows, and podcast the show at minnesotapublicradio.org. Look for the In the Loop homepage. I'm Jeff Horwich. I'll see you online. I'll see you on the radio. And I hope to see you at the next Story Slam.
Hey, everybody. This is Jeff again with a quick note. I am just about to hop on a plane to Denver. I'm going out there for the first of two political convention shows called Behind Party Lines. For this first show, we're locking about 20 Democrats in a studio with me, and we're going to dig deep into why they wound up in that party to begin with. The next week, back here in St. Paul, we'll do the same thing with Republicans. Should be a great break from all the speeches and typical political analysis. You can hear those hours this week and next on Thursday, the final day of each convention, at 2 p.m. And we'll serve them up on the In the Loop podcast. Hope you tune in.